Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
So I want to talk some more about Kobe off the top. Another day later, and it still feels surreal to be talking about the passing of Kobe Bryant. To be talking about Kobe in the past tense. Completely surreal to see flowers on the bench of the UConn women's game honoring Gianna. Completely surreal to see Novak Djokovic talking to John McEnroe about Kobe after his quarterfinal.
It's been a tough 34 hours in the sports world. Obviously, with the death of Kobe Bryant, I notice you are paying tribute, and I'm sure you have something to say right now about him.
I don't know what we could say, you know. It really caught us by surprise, you know. And, you know, he was one of the greatest athletes of all time. He inspired myself and many, many other people around the world. And I had that fortune to have a personal relationship with him over the last 10 years. And when I needed some advice and some support, you know, he was there for me. He was my mentor, my friend, and it's just heartbreaking to see and to hear what has happened to him and his daughter. It's unbelievable.
I mean, I could spend the entire program playing clips of tributes to Kobe coming in from all around the world. And it would be worthwhile because it would be a way of showing the impact that he had, both professionally and personally on people. And as the world continues to react to the passing of Kobe Bryant, tonight's Clippers-Lakers game at Staples, which would have been the first for the Lakers since Kobe's passing, has been postponed. The league said in a statement, quote, "The decision was made out of respect for the Lakers organization, which is deeply grieving the tragic loss of Lakers legend Kobe Bryant, his daughter, Gianna, and seven other people in a helicopter crash on Sunday," end quote. The Lakers themselves also released their first formal statement since the tragedy, quote, "In consultation with the NBA league office, the game schedule between the LA Lakers and the LA Clippers for Tuesday, January 28th will be postponed and scheduled for a future date." It goes on, quote, "The Los Angeles Lakers would like to thank all of you for the tremendous outpouring of support and condolences. This is a very difficult time for all of us. We continue to support the Bryant family and will share more information as it is available," end quote. This to me is the right decision. Playing tonight may have been cathartic for some, but it is still way too raw. It is still way too painful for others. And while it might be kind of a hassle to reschedule other games, the fact that it's a matchup between two teams who share the same city and the same building, there was no good reason not to postpone this game. The Lakers canceled practice yesterday as the team brought grief counselors in to support them. I mean, it would have been pretty ridiculous to have grief counselors for the organization one day and then play a game 24 hours later. And this is not just a Laker thing. And it's not just the Lakers who are dealing with it. You saw how emotional Doc Rivers was on Sunday when he was talking about Kobe. Yesterday, Clipper Lou Williams, who played with Kobe, tweeted, quote, "Been crying on and off. Have a random thought about things we spoke about, then laugh, cry again. Then I tell myself, tighten up. Mamba was tough. Wipe my eyes, cry again. R.I.P. Kobe." Williams was also tweeting back and forth with Nick Young and laughing about a particular memory. Quote, "We got blew out in Portland. He took everybody's Kobe's and said they couldn't wear it because we was soft." It's a perfect tweet to read. Really a perfect tweet to read yesterday. It felt like a lot of people needed that tweet because it was funny. It was really funny. Kobe was a really funny dude. Extremely intense, extremely focused, but he was a funny guy. Coming back into the locker room and telling everybody that they were not allowed to wear his shoes because they were soft. That was perfect. And then in response to that Lou Williams tweet, somebody posted a clip of Lou on the All the Smoke show with Matt Barnes and Steven Jackson. And it's another great Kobe story, quite possibly after the same blowout in Portland.
He gonna be mad at me for this, but look, we had a blowout. We got blew out in Portland, and he came in the locker room and he was like, "From now on out, every time down the court, I touch the ball. Y'all gonna learn what it's like to play with Kobe Bean f***ing Bryant." And I'm sitting there looking like, "Okay, oh, this is serious."
Again, it feels like we needed something like that. We needed that moment. We needed that memory. And hopefully as the shock begins to wear off and the sharp pain softens, there'll be more of those moments. But it's going to take time, I would imagine. It is a process. And while there are moments to laugh and we need those moments, there are still waves and waves of grief. LeBron summed it up in a post on Instagram. Quote, "I'm not ready, but here I go. Man, I'm sitting here trying to write something for this post, but every time I try, I begin crying again, just thinking about you, niece Gigi, and the friendship, bond, brotherhood we had. I literally just heard your voice Sunday morning before I left Philly to head back to LA. Didn't think for one bit in a million years that that would be the last conversation we'd have. WTF, I'm heartbroken and devastated, my brother. Man, I love you, big bro. My heart goes to Vanessa and the kids. I promise you I'll continue your legacy, man. You mean so much to us all here, especially Laker Nation, and it's my responsibility to keep this, to put this bleep on my back and keep it going. Please give me the strength from the heavens above and watch over me. I got us here. There's so much more I want to say, but I just can't right now because I can't get through it. Until we meet again, my brother. Mamba for life. Gigi for life." That is so raw. That is so real. That is so personal. And it feels like in some way LeBron is speaking for millions of Laker fans. Like, you read that and you feel the emotion in that post, and there was no way they were going to play a basketball game tonight. Not a basketball game that counts for anything. Because as you can see, it's still way too raw. The pain is still too fresh. Sometimes playing through something is a good idea, and then sometimes it's just not. Sometimes it's important to stop and acknowledge what has happened and how it's impacting everybody. It's okay for people who were close to Kobe to be crushed by this. It's okay for people who never met Kobe to be crushed by this. That's how grief works. The truth is, there'll probably never feel like a right time for the Lakers to play after this. But tonight would have absolutely have been the wrong time. 1-800-636-8686. Again, I'm taking telephone calls and your thoughts and your memories, your remembrances. If you want to share anything about Kobe, what he meant to you, what he meant to the city of Los Angeles. Again, a lot of people outside this area don't get it. I don't expect you to get it. I'm not telling you I'm here to explain it to you. You can't. I can't explain this to you. If you're in this town or you're a Laker fan, you understood the relationship between Kobe and this city and this city and Kobe. And there's never been anything like it. Good friend of the program. He is Charles Robinson. Charles, good to have you back. How are you?
What's up, brother? How are you doing?
Appreciate you.
Today in Miami, finally.
Good. So you beat me there. So how is it?
It's getting better. It's getting better. A lot of 49ers fans. I as much as I think everyone says, well, the 50-year drought with the Chiefs will make this a Chiefs crowd. We'll see. I mean, it sounds like the ticket prices are being pushed and a lot of 49ers fans are swarming in.
All right, so I want to get your thoughts on the matchup, and also the tickets are actually a story, and I'll get to that in a minute. But as always, there are a lot of things to talk to you about, but I just want to start really quickly with the passing of Kobe Bryant, because you covered the Olympics in Beijing. Yeah. What do you remember about the impact of Kobe there?
I remember we set out at one point. You know, that was like the Phelps Olympics. He's gonna have set the record for golds. Mark Spitz's, he was gonna shatter Mark Spitz's record, and we went out with a photo of Michael Phelps. And when you went through China, there were some people knew Michael Phelps, where everybody knew who Kobe was. As soon as they found out you were from America, they would they bring up Kobe, even if they didn't speak English. You'd hear Kobe Bryant, Kobe Bryant, Kobe Bryant, and it was remarkable to me just the broad impact that he clearly had amongst the populace there. And then I remember the opening ceremonies, And I think the two guys who got the biggest ovations during the entirety of the open ceremonies, Yao Ming and Kobe Bryant, were the two guys where it was just like the entire stadium exploded. And, you know, it's just, it's when you come here to the Super Bowl and you talk to these guys, you see Richard Sherman get emotional. And it was interesting. I kind of remember there's this line from Kill Bill, you know, the movie where Hattori Hanzo, who's this, the sword maker, and he makes this sword, and he says, so sharp that if you encounter God, God will be cut. And it's such a halting line, but it reminds me, when you talk to athletes, this is like God being cut. This is, there's a sense of mortality here that is delivered to athletes that they are not accustomed to dealing with, and that's why, you know, you kind of see giants all of a sudden, you know, being so vulnerable and moved and brought to tears. And to me, that's really what struck me about this.
It's an amazing depiction right there. Hey, sports fans, listen up. I've got a daily sports podcast that I want to tell you about. One that you want to check out from Wondery and The Athletic. It's called The Lead. Every weekday morning, The Lead brings you a deep dive into the biggest sports stories of the day from the Athletic's all-star team of local and national sports reporters. Stories like, where did the Niners' new star running back Raheem Mostert come from? Or what can Zion do for the Pelicans? So if you're looking for the full story behind last night's scores and today's hot takes, make sure you subscribe to The Lead from Wondery and The Athletic. Check it out. Charles Robinson is joining us, and I agree with you. So there is no convenient way to move off that, but I will. The Browns announced the hiring of Eagles VP of Football Ops, Andrew Berry, as their next GM. You have been all over that story. For those who do not know, what kind of a GM are they getting in Berry, and then how does he fit in the organizational structure in Cleveland?
Well, extremely smart guy. I mean, there's no doubt about that. He's 32 years old, the youngest known GM in NFL history. He's a guy that he's been through the Indianapolis Colts organization. Obviously, he was with the Browns for a while and then went to the Eagles. And what struck me about him is when you talk to evaluators across the league, people who have come in contact with him, they all say, you know, really good things about him. And they're different types of evaluators. You have old school guys, you have analytics guys, and they all tend to say really good things about him. But, you know, look, the Browns, we've been here before. There's been excitement about hires before. The proof is going to be in the pudding. He's going to be a very analytics-driven guy. Kevin Stefanski, obviously the offensive coordinator from the Vikings who was hired to be the head coach, is in that vein. So, you know, look, the alignment inside the Browns, it's probably the most on the same page as it's been during Jimmy Haslam's ownership. But it's all about winning and losing, and the Browns have done nothing but lose. So he's going to have to prove it, you know, that he's worth the fanfare. But very bright guy, and I think, you know, his press conference is on February 5th, and once Browns fans have a chance to kind of go through that process with him, I think they're going to be pretty excited about what they're getting.
Charles Robinson is my guest. Now, you mentioned the ticket prices. We're 5 days out, and you wrote a piece on this, that it might be the most expensive Super Bowl average ticket in the history of the league. Why is that, and then how expensive would the average ticket be?
Well, it's interesting. It's not relenting either. It's sort of built. You know, I had a chance to talk to somebody from StubHub actually today. I'm going to update that story. And, you know, they said, look, in California, you can see 49ers fans are definitely flooding in, because they said, look, since they won the NFC title game, there's been like a 200% plus spike out of California in sales. And that's, I think they said, 3.6 times higher than Missouri. So, you know, 49ers fans might be a 6-hour flight, but they're buying, they're coming in. And, you know, interestingly, Mexico has had like a 4% representation of overall sales, which is another indicator that it might be additional 49ers fans. And it's driving ticket prices. Like, everybody wants, you know, that you have two fan bases that have a voracious appetite, one into this game. And, you know, I think brokers have kind of figured out the secondary market. They figured out how to, you know, control the flow of tickets to kind of keep, you know, prices where they need to be. Nobody's dumping anything on the market. There was no speculation in terms of people pre-selling tickets for this one. So it's just been steady demand. And look, it's Miami, man. Like, we're down here, and, you know, if you're down for sunshine and umbrella drinks rather than being in, you know, Kansas City or San Francisco where it's cold right now, come here, because trust me, there's no running out of coconuts or umbrellas.
Yeah, let me tell you something. I'm a California guy. I was in Kansas City last weekend. I'm eager to get to Miami. I know exactly what you're talking about. All right, so what kind of thoughts do you have about the matchup itself?
This is going to be a hell of a game. Like, I really do. I've seen some people say, well, this is going to be a blowout. Like, they think, like, this is going to be that weird, wonky year where it's like, you know, the Seahawks and the Broncos with the high-powered offense, the great defense, and then Seattle just, you know, curb-stomped Denver. And I don't know. I think this is going to be a little more even-keeled than people expect. To me, though, this all comes down to one thing, and really I think it's similar to what happened between Seattle and Denver. If San Francisco can hit Pat Mahomes, I mean, that's, you know, you go over the totality of Pat Mahomes, you know, film this year, and guys will tell you, pro personnel guys who have seen the Chiefs and really broken it down, they'll tell you, look, he rarely gets decked. You know, he's just not a guy who gets hammered in games, and when he does, you know, he's mortal. He shows, you know, flaws, and particularly when you go back to last season, you know, the times where he struggled occasionally was when teams were able to hit him. So, you know, if you're the 49ers, your bread and butter is that front seven. And if those guys get to Pat Mahomes consistently, I think that's the way they're going to slow down this Kansas City offense. But I would be stunned. If this turns out to be a bad game, it would be a tremendous disappointment, because I think these are two teams that can both challenge each other on both sides of the ball. And to me, it'll be a lot of fun. A lot of stars in this game.
I agree with you. I've seen the same thing you have, that some people are calling for a blowout, and a blowout by Kansas City. Like, I'm not saying they can't win. I'm not saying that a blowout's an impossibility, but I don't see it happening. I think that is a close game. I think that's a great game. Before I let you go, Charles Robinson, my guest, based on your reporting, how likely is it that Tom Brady is going to be playing someplace else next year?
Oh, boy. You know, I still put the percentage low, but I'm telling you, I think people are misunderstanding how he's going to approach this process. You know, I talked to Tom Kahn, who's Peyton Manning's agent, and I asked him, I said, what was that like when Peyton went under the market? Because really, we haven't seen a quarterback sort of this ilk, you know, in this historical relevance sort of hit the market before. And, you know, Kahn said, look, man, you know, he told me the first day that, you know, he hit free agency, you know, the phone exploded. He said, we had like 12 teams instantly that were like, we are interested. We want to talk to you. And, you know, so I would think there would be some comparisons with Tom, and I think the Patriots, Robert Kraft, they want to get him, if they can get him extended, get another deal in place before free agency hits, they want to do that. But I'm just telling people, if he makes it to day one of free agency, and it probably won't even need to be that, because people will be approaching his agent Don Yee at the combine, that when that phone turns on, you know, day one of free agency, there are going to be a lot of teams that call with interest in Tom Brady, and I would expect he's going to be inclined to at least listen to some of those pitches. And frankly, I think if he makes it that far, I think the percentage chances of him leaving New England rise dramatically.
So let me follow up really quickly. If you're Tom Brady, what do you think that he's looking for in a new team, if he's looking for a new team? I mean, is it only about a great offensive line, better targets than what he has, or is there more to it than that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that he's developed this really close friendship with Manning, and I absolutely believe he's going to end up talking to Manning about this. And you know what's interesting is when Manning went into the whole process, he looked at, let me see what the offensive line's like, let me see what the division's like around this team, like, what are you going to, if I'm going to play for a few years, what am I dealing with within the division, you know, geographically. Manning made it really way more about football than about the locale. And I think with Tom, even I've fallen into that trap of like, well, geez, he wouldn't go here, he wouldn't go there, he's not going to go to, you know, geez, he's not going to go to Indianapolis over, say, Los Angeles to play for the Chargers. And the thing about Manning, it was all about football. He knew, this is my legacy's on the line here. I'm leaving the Colts. This is my flourish, and I'm not going to go to a place where I cannot succeed from a football standpoint. So I think people should look at, as you said, offensive line, head coach, skill position pieces, the fit in the division. I just think very football centered, because Tom Brady's not going there to walk into the sunset. He's going there to prove, hey, I still had something left, and you should have never let the door open for me.
It's going to be really interesting. He is a senior NFL reporter for Yahoo, the co-host of the Yahoo Sports NFL podcast. He is already in Miami. He is Charles Robinson. Appreciate you, Charles. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jim. I look forward to seeing you.
I look forward to it. In fact, the tributes to Kobe continued at Super Bowl media night as well. And it started with a moment of silence.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join us in a moment of silence as the National Football League extends its deepest condolences to the friends and families of all those who lost their lives in yesterday's tragedy, including NBA legend Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna. Kobe was an extraordinary athlete who thrilled and entertained sports fans around the world for a generation.
And then you had player after player sharing their thoughts on Kobe. Chiefs defensive end Frank Clark said, quote, "He is one of my biggest idols. The one person I look to for inspiration and strength when going through what I was going through growing up was Kobe Bryant." 49ers tight end George Kittle had this to say.
You know, Kobe was, other than my parents, like, he was the reason I played sports. Just his mindset, his mama mentality. And I wore the number 24 in high school, like my freshman, sophomore year, because of him. And I wore Kobe Bryant basketball shoes because of Kobe Bryant. And every time I laced up my basketball shoes, I felt like I had Kobe Bryant with me. I had a little part of him. I had his jumper. I had his fadeaway. The amount of hours I spent practicing that fadeaway from the corner. And I never made it, but I tried, and I always thought I was Kobe. So, like, I mean, he's an icon. He was a hero of mine.
So many great, great athletes would talk about Kobe Bryant just like that. Richard Sherman talked about how Kobe was a tremendous inspiration to him, especially in the guidance he got and the support he got from him in trying to respond and recover and rehab that Achilles injury.
I guess the biggest mamba mentality moment of my career was getting up from a torn Achilles and walking off the field. You know, I saw him do it. You know, I saw him make two free throws and walk off with a torn Achilles. And once I tore mine, I knew I had to walk off. You know, I knew, like you said before, we're different animals, but the same beast. Like, we got a lot, we're built up a lot of the same stuff, and I had to be able to walk that off.
Amazing, Richard Sherman. And when I think about a tough, tough guy, I think about Richard Sherman. I think about where he grew up, how he came up, the way he plays the game, his ferocity, his mentality. And he's saying, I got a lot of that Mamba mentality in me. I got a lot of that from Kobe Bryant. He went on and added this.
He's a friend of mine. He was a mentor. He meant a lot to this world, and he made a positive impact. And there's nothing that I can say to really qualify his impact on myself and on others. I just know how he would have, you know, wanted me to take this and to react, especially in this moment in this game. You know, I was really sad yesterday, and I was sad this morning. I was kind of down. I was in the dumps, and then I just thought about what he would tell me. You know what I mean? He would tell me, stop being a baby and man up and play it and do it in his honor and win this game for him. You know, and that's what we're gonna try to do. You know, I'm gonna go out there and try to play some dominating ball. Just like he wanted. You know, the Mamba mentality still lives on.
The Mamba mentality still lives on. And sure enough, as you'd expect, as good as Frank Clark was yesterday when he broke out his Black Elvis handle and glossed himself the craziest SOB in the league, that's how good Kyle Shanahan was when he was talking about getting beaten in online Madden and getting roasted by preteens. Shanahan said, quote, "Once I realized I was getting killed by second graders with them talking so much smack, I eventually retired," end quote. And as good as they both were, last night was all about Richard Sherman and George Kittle, two guys created for moments like media night. They were so good, they had each other freaking out. Like when Sherman came running up on Kittle at the podium like he was some sort of crazed fan.
I love George Kittle! I love George Kittle! Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God!
You guys see that? That was crazy. It was Richard Sherman, everybody. Wow. I'm sure. Wow.
These dudes are loose. No wonder they were both so fired up to see each other. I think they knew that they were going to be that good on media night. Kittle talked about headbutting walls before games and the fact that he's been playing with a torn labrum in his shoulder for 2 years and really isn't in a hurry to get it fixed. Quote, "It's football. You play football. You just play injured. That's how it is. A lot of it comes from my dad. He played for Hayden Fry University in the 80s. He used to tell me about the injuries he played with. One time he tore his ACL in week 6, and then he played in the Rose Bowl in week 12. So if he could do that, I can do anything," end quote. And apparently doing anything also includes outing his quarterback from one of his worst habits.
A not-so-perfect side of him, He's the worst texter of all time. I'm telling you, he leaves me on red all the time. I'll be like, hey, Jimmy, I got a question. Maybe on this play, should I run my route like this? No response. Jimmy, you want to go to a movie? No response. And then the next day, he's like, yeah, I got your text. I just didn't respond. Thanks, Jim. That's awesome. So, yeah, he's a bad texter. Bad communication.
So, yes, he's a bad texter. Bad communication with our quarterback. And then deciding who would be the first guy out in a team-wide Royal Rumble.
We'll draw first. Wow. I think we'd throw Jimmy out first.
Yeah.
No. Bully him. He gets too much attention. Just throw him out of the ring. Get him out of there. Let the attention be on us for once.
So, like, on any other night, any other media night, Kittle is your runaway star. But we know Sherm can hold his own. We knew Sherm would. Why don't we spin the wheel of topics and see what Sherm has to say about any number of things? Hey, Sherm, how about Eli Manning, Hall of Famer or nah?
The teams haven't always been great. He hasn't always been surrounded by talent, and when he has, he's played pretty well. But to run through the playoffs and some of the teams he beat, and to beat the all-time greatest quarterback of all time twice, and two of the best teams of all time, so he beat an undefeated team that had Randy Moss on it, who had just come off a record-breaking season. Like, who does that? How do you do that? And so for those reasons, I believe he's a Hall of Famer. That's a Hall of Fame thing. So you can't not put that guy in Hall of Fame.
That's why you don't mess with Sherm. Like, if you want to debate Sherm on any meaningful topic, just know that he's going to be ready to go. He'll know. He was also asked about the embarrassing lack of black head coaches in the NFL. He said, quote, majority white coaches, majority black league. It's odd. I think it needs to be addressed. And I think guys need to take a stand and address it. But players are being asked about it, and we have nothing to do with it. Sure, we would love more black coaches to get opportunities, but we don't call those shots. You have to ask the owners. There's 32 of them who call those shots, and I don't think they get enough pressure. End quote. I mean, I keep going on and on, but here's one more. A story about why he wanted to put his former Stanford coach, Jim Harbaugh, out of the NFL.
Jed had a funny story about when I was coming out because they had a higher draft grade on me than most teams, and Harbaugh came and took me off the draft board, and he was like, he was really upset about that, but I'll let you guys ask him about the rest of it. Honestly, I wanted to put him out the league, and once I got that done, I mean, I got no animosity towards the 49ers or any organization.
Once he put Harbaugh out of the league, it was okay for him to join the 49ers. Like, he had a grudge to settle, he settled it, and then everything was good between he and the 49ers. Vintage Richard Sherman, and that's why he and Kittle won media night. That was fun. These guys were having a lot of fun with it. Pretty loose. And then you've got the Chiefs, and almost to a man, every single person in that building, player, coach, staffer, everybody, they so badly want to get the big fellow a win. They so badly want Andy Reid to get a Super Bowl. It's been written a lot already this week, but it's true. Like, everybody around Andy Reid wants Andy Reid to win more than Andy Reid wants to win. And Andy Reid really wants to win. But there's so many guys with so much invested in it and him who so badly want to get him that win. But then again, emotion only gets you so far, right? Emotion is going to have problems blocking Bosa, Buckner, and the fellas. I want to talk to you for a minute about Root Insurance. Like, what if good drivers did not have to pay for all the bad drivers? Root Insurance thinks that the old way of pricing car insurance is not right. It's not fair. So Root developed a mobile app which measures driving behavior. By removing bad drivers from the equation, Root saved good drivers up to 52% in 2019. So gone are the days where your car insurance rate is based on your credit score, your age, your gender, or your zip code. With Root, it's car insurance made easy, using an app to base rates primarily on how you drive. Better drivers deserve better rates, right? That's why the Root app uses driving behavior to determine car insurance rates. And in 2019, Root was the fastest growing direct insurance company in the United States. All you have to do is download the Root Insurance app, drive normally for a few weeks during the Root test drive, and then see how much you can save. Do not wait. Give it a try. Head to your app store, download the Root Insurance app, sign up in less than a minute, and start your test drive today. That's R-O-O-T. Again, Download the Root app today or visit joinroot.com and learn more and see how much money you can save. Not available in all states. Disclaimers may apply. Visit joinroot.com for details. He is a friend of the program. He is Howard Beck. Howard, it's nice to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing all right, Romy. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Same. In fact, I want to say, Howard, I always look forward to this. I always appreciate having you on the program, but not under these circumstances. So let me kind of rephrase that and ask you again. How are you doing right now? How do you feel?
I'm spent. I'm emotionally spent. I don't pretend to have known Kobe on the level that a lot of his teammates and friends and others did. But any of us who spent any time around that team in those years, I had known him a long time. You know, we weren't hanging out. We weren't going out to drinks or going bowling together, but we had a very good relationship. I'm hurting like a lot of people are, like his fans are, like his family, certainly, and former teammates, everybody grieves in their own way. Everybody processes their own way. And we all had a different kind of relationship. People who didn't even ever meet him, fans, you know, have a relationship that is powerful, that goes way beyond needing to meet somebody, right? And so for me, it's somewhere in between. And I've written, I've talked, I've talked a lot. I've made the rounds yesterday on you know, some TV and radio, and I feel like it's got to be therapy, right? It's the only way to try to process. And I just want to say, Jim, real quick, I know I'm rambling a little bit, but
no, not at all.
As you guys are coming back in with the bumper music with Iggy Pop, Lust for Life, which, by the way, not only an awesome song, but Lust for Life, like that encapsulates Kobe as much as anything, too, because he did. And in my years in L.A., I didn't know your show until I got to L.A. And like all of your listeners, and you always would say it, you're not going to get it at first. You're going to think, who is this guy? What's the top? I had that same experience, Jim. but I hear Lust for Life coming back from commercial, and I think Jim Rome show, and I think about those years I was in L.A., living in Hermosa Beach, covering the Lakers, getting to know Kobe. Like, it just places me back in that time so much. And once I did get the show, I was listening to you every friggin' day, coming back from Laker practices and sitting there in my apartment, writing about the Lakers, writing about Kobe, your show on in the background. It took me back, and I thought I'd mention that as we go.
I understand this, and I appreciate that, Howard, very much. And I know exactly what you're saying. I do understand that. Howard Beck is joining us. You know, on top of that, you've got this great remembrance piece up on Bleacher Report. It's on Kobe. It's entitled The Making of an NBA Icon. It starts with an interaction you had with him way back in the day. You were at a Lakers practice, and you were talking to Robert Horry, and somebody calls out, Howard, do you need me today? Who was that, and what do you remember about that moment?
My back is turned. I hear that voice, that quote, do you need me today? And I turn around, and it's Kobe. And they used to practice at L.A. Southwest College, not too far from Inglewood, and this is before they had their own practice facility. And there's a zillion doors out of that gym, too. Like, he could have just bolted. And things were a little different back then. Less media, less hype, less spotlight. I think it was – I'm pretty sure it was somewhere in that 97-98 season, my first year, so his second year. And he's not larger-than-life Kobe yet. He's not even a starter yet. And he could have just left. And we knew each other a little bit. We were still like in that early phase of you know, me being a new beat writer and trying to get to know the guys. But I felt like we had kind of hit it off or connected really easily when I first met him at training camp and they were practiced in Palm Desert that year. But he could have left and he didn't. And it always struck me. And I let him go because I knew that even though he was not yet that Kobe, there was, you know, a lot of demands on these guys. And certainly him, and I, you know, you don't need to wear them out every day. But it struck me because he could have left. And I've told that story on occasion over the last 20 years, and people kind of see it like with this jaded lens of, oh, he's trying to cultivate a relationship, or he's just trying to whatever, be, you know, manipulative. And I you had to have heard it and been there to know it was genuine. He was just like, he knows, hey, we need Kobe, we need Shaq. and he was leaving, and he wanted to check in to make sure I didn't have anything for him that day. I just, it always stuck with human cool thing, you know. We're reporters. We demand a lot of these guys. We need a lot. He's a player. He's got a lot of demands on him. But he understood. He understood that that was the job.
Howard Beck is joining us. I tend to agree with that. I think that's exactly what that was. Now, as you pointed out in the past, there is this ghost of Jordan that essentially haunted an entire generation of players, but it sure didn't seem to bother Kobe. How would you explain that?
That's one of those things where it's like when we try to figure out, like, all right, he was so driven, he was so dedicated, he was so consumed by the game. Where does that come from? And, like, I don't think there's an answer to these, to some of these questions. It's fascinating to try to explore the psyche of Kobe and other guys who are at that level. And it's, I don't know that we ever can find a satisfactory answer, whether it's nature, nurture, chemical, the way your brain's wired, whatever. But Kobe thought he could be like Mike because he had done everything possible to emulate him. He told me a couple of years ago when I did a story about the ghost of Jordan and how it had haunted an entire generation aside from him. And he said, you know, I asked him, well, but, you know, people always compared you guys because you did so much like him. He goes, yeah, I damn near stole every one of his moves. Hmm. And then you see the videos that are circulating the last couple of days that show Kobe and Jordan side by side, every move you can imagine. And it is picture perfect. Like, Kobe studied him, mimicked him, perfected him, just incredible. And like, why was he undaunted when so many others, like, just shied away from that? It's just the way Kobe was built. The guy was just so incredibly confident. And behind that confidence, of course, is that work ethic. You're confident when you know you've prepared, right? And that's really, again, to me, that is so much the lesson of Kobe Bryant and his career and his success, is that it wasn't just his talent. It wasn't just these physical gifts, and he certainly had some. But he worked his tail off to become the player that he did. And that's what I want people to remember.
That has always been my biggest takeaway on Kobe and the career he had and the success he had. Because, as you point out, as great as he was not the best athlete on the floor. As an example, you point out Vince Carter could jump higher. AI was quicker. Tracy McGrady was longer. He was taller. So I know the answer to the question, and you touched on it, but how do you explain the career he had if he was not as gifted as all these other guys?
Yeah, because he was going to stay at the gym for 3 hours longer than anybody else and arrive 3 hours before anybody else and spend his summers not like in Cancun or anywhere else, but in the gym working. I tell the story in there too. Like, there was a summer where he just like planted a bunch of chairs around the gym and used them as defenders. And, you know, anybody else tells you that story, well, here's how I spent my summer, you'd be like, yeah, whatever. You probably also shot numbers and, you know, lost 20 pounds of fat. These are such like almost like these obvious cliches of like, here's my summer workout that I'm going to brag about. But it was Kobe. I absolutely have no doubt in my mind that that was true, that he used the chairs as defenders. It's just as, I don't want to say as simple as that, Jim, because it's not simple. But, you know, I do think a lot of other players, if they worked nearly as hard as he did, would have had the same or better careers, because he didn't jump the highest. He wasn't the strongest or the fastest. He just had this determination to be better, to be almost perfect, right? Like, we talk about his Jordan mimicry is damn near perfect, because that's what he was shooting for. That's how long he worked on it. He just would keep going over these moves over and over and over. And to have the kind of patience and focus to do that is just astounding.
We're talking to Howard Beck. He's sharing his thoughts on Kobe Bryant. Now, Howard, go back to the point that you made about nature versus nurture. To me, that's always been one of the most fascinating questions of all ages. And I don't mean as it relates to Kobe. I think about this every day, all day. And I'm not nearly where I want to be on this, but I'm fascinated by nature versus nurture. I ask athletes and coaches about this all the time. Are you wired for it, or can you manufacture it? Can you develop it? So in terms of Kobe and this Mamba mentality and this toughness and this ferocity and this steely exterior, did he have that from the jump and day one? Like, for instance, how different was Kobe from when you first met him to the very end?
Well, the personality and the way he interacted with people and everything like that evolved. And this is one of the other things that I always try to remind people. And Jim, you know this too, because you've interviewed, you know, I don't know how many thousands of athletes at this point. But these guys are introduced to us, especially in the NBA, at a very young age. Kobe was 17 when he declared and 18 when he arrived in the NBA, 19 when I met him, and he checks out as a 37-year-old a few years ago. And like all of us are evolving and changing, hopefully, from our late teens to our 30s. And so what did not change with him, and look, there was all those ups and downs, right, with just with his relationships with us in the media, with teammates, coaches, whoever. But what was constant was the dedication to the game. Like that part of it never, ever changed. And I think that was probably how he was ever since he was a kid shooting hoops in Italy, watching his dad play professionally over there. And you want to go to the nature part and you say, well, his dad was a pro ball player, but Joe Bryant was never anywhere near the basketball player that Kobe became. And, you know, Kobe was self-made. And I think he used to credit his mom, Pam, actually more for the, just that diligence or the work ethic, the single-mindedness. And yeah, again, like, is that because he patterned after her? Is it something that it was, you know, just mimicking, or was it something that is in the genes? I don't know. But that was who he was to his core.
You know, right. The other question I would ask, and you know, I would sit with him on occasion. I was like you, Howard. I had a relationship with Kobe, but I would not say that we were best friends. We didn't hang out. But, you know, he came on the show a number of times, and we would have an occasional dinner because we live in the same area. And I always tried to get at it, and he would never quite give me the answer. But my question was, like, why? You know, if you're not wired like that, and you didn't pop out like that, then certainly you cultivated that. But it's not like this was his way out of a fierce environment. It's not like it was either this or life on the streets. You look at the way he was brought up, you know, in Italy with some affluence. Like, where in the world did that drive come from when he had a really good life?
Yeah, right? Because we in the sports media like to often seize on that narrative of guys who came – right? Like the hard scrabble upbringing or the, I might be dead now if I did not find basketball kind of thing. That's the universal story that we're so used to. And it's obviously a very sad one if you think about how common that is. Sad statement about our society, but Kobe is different because, as you point out, he didn't need it to survive. He didn't need it to escape, a bad neighborhood. He would have had it pretty good probably regardless. Again, it's just some internal spark, something in him that said, I love this game. And let's start there too. You know, you don't want to make it sound like drudgery. It's not just work. He loved it. He absolutely loved the game. And that's what his Dear Basketball, film, his short film was about that won the Oscar, was about his love of the game. Again, that's not manufactured. That stuff is real. And that love of the game for him meant, well, if I'm going to play it, I want to be really good. And if I'm going to be really good, I might as well be great. And if I'm going to be great, I'm going to have to really work at it. And that's fine because I love it.
And finally, Howard, you have this great story also about going to see Kobe during his final season and saying that you were not going to be able to beat his final game. What was his response to that?
I thought he might just strike me down the spot. I went to him a couple weeks before what was going to be his final game of his career, and I said, hey, I just wanted to say thanks and good luck with everything. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for everything you've done. Congratulations, whatever. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, I said, well, I'm not going to be here. He's like, what are you? I said, well, it's 3,000 miles, Kobe. I live in New York now. Like, it's hard to get out here. And so that's when he says, man, you can't be here at 17, meaning his age when he came in, and not be here at 37. Come on, man. Finish the journey, man. And he kind of smacked me in the chest, and he's kind of smiling as he says it. It's not like some threatening way. It was just kind of this incredulous, you have to be here. And again, like, Kobe didn't have to say that. I'm one of how many people who has covered him. I did have 7 years, you know, with him every day on the beat, but it was just such an incredible thing that it actually on some level meant something to him that I would or would not be there. And I don't pretend again to think or believe that I was more important to Kobe than any number of other people in or out of the media. But he could have just said, hey, Howard, that's great. It's been nice knowing you. Thanks for the stories back in the day, or maybe not. And it was just like, that could have been it. But he was like, no, man, you got to be there. And he was right. And I did go back and I did finish the journey as he implored me to do. And that night, as you know, was incredible. And I'm so glad I was there for it. And I'm so glad I followed Kobe's advice. He was right. He was right.
He meant it. He meant it. It's just, it's so unusual, Howard. Like, you've done this a long, long time. I've done this a long, long time. I was talking to Adrian Wojnarowski, another guy you know well and a guy you compete with, but there's obviously a lot of respect. He's done extremely well. He came on the show yesterday and he said, you know, Jim, I'm going to say this and I mean this, and I bet you'd say the same thing. I probably would not be where I am in my career if not for the access and the credibility that Kobe Bryant gave me. And you'd probably say the same thing. I said, oh, no, 100% I would say the same thing. 100% I would say the same thing. And probably you had a job to do and you had a beat to cover, Howard, but probably on some level you would say the same thing as well. It's really rare and really unique. Honestly, like, and he would text me, Howard, sometimes, I'm sorry, excuse me. He would text me and he would say, like, yo, fam. And I'm like, the guy just called me fam. I'm like the rest of you. I'm jaded. I'm an older guy. I've done this a long time. Why am I doing this? I'm no fanboy. I'm not going to live like that. But he'd hit me with fam and you just, it would have like an impact on you. Like, does he mean that? I think he means that. And I think you know what I'm saying.
For sure. And I touched on this in the column as well, that's, you know, we're only as good in this job as the stories and the people that we cover and the time they give us,
right,
the access, the insight, the thoughts. You know, they don't have to. You know, yeah, sure, it's part of the gig. You know, you're a pro athlete. There's a certain amount of media access and availability you sign up for. It's in your contract, all that. But you can do the minimum. You don't have to give of yourself. You can just give the pat cliches and walk away, and you'll have fulfilled your obligations. But it's the guys like Kobe and Shaq and several others I've covered, and so many guys from those teams, by the way, Rick Fox, Derek Fisher, Robert Horry, Horace Grant, Brian Shaw, that was my first major sports beat, and that certainly made my career. The LA Daily News, you know, that gig covering the Lakers, that's what springboarded me to the New York Times in 2004. My 9 years at the Times is what opened the door for me to go to Bleacher Report and do a lot of the things I've been doing the last several years and a lot more TV and my podcast. Like, yeah, if not for these guys being generous with their time and their thoughts, then there is none of that. And Kobe is a huge, huge part of that, of course. And so many of us, I think, are indebted to him. I just note, like, my buddy Mark Stein, who I think you know well, too, and Stein, one of the great all-time basketball writers as well, got the Kurt Gowdy Award at the Basketball Hall of Fame last year, and he devoted a ton of his speech to the fact that Steve Nash and Dirk Nowitzki with the Mavericks had given so much of themselves to him and allowed him to be great at his job and to tell those stories meaningfully, and that he wouldn't be standing there without them. And I feel much the same way about Kobe and Shaq and those Laker teams.
Access is so important. Howard Beck, a senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. He spent 7 years on the Lakers beat. Again, host of the Full 48 podcast, good friend of the program. You know, you have done this for the past 24 hours plus. Howard, I'm glad you did another one. So good to spend some time with you, and I really appreciate your thoughts on that. Howard, thanks so much.
No, Jim, thank you so much, and thanks for doing everything you do it at the highest level that you do it at, too, man, because I've admired it for years. I've been Plitz, you know, just a pleasure to be part of your program multiple times a year, and thanks so much.
I do want to talk about what happened last night in the NBA. All across the NBA, every team and a number of players were paying tribute to Kobe. Moments of silence, 24-second shot violations, 8-second backcourt violations, number changes, marked-up sneaks. You've probably heard this a few times, but it's worth repeating. Kobe, of course, was this generation's Michael Jordan. Kobe grew up watching Mike. The guys on the court today grew up watching Kobe. And somebody who really admired, adored, in fact, Kobe, and knew him pretty well, is Sacramento Kings guard Buddy Hield. He wrote in a 2016 column for the Players Tribune, quote, "Kobe was a myth for me growing up. I'm from a neighborhood in the Bahamas called 8 Mile Rock, about as far away from LA as you can get. But as a kid, I only wore number 8 or 24. So Buddy first met Kobe when he was playing at Oklahoma. On draft night back in 2016, Kobe texted him and told him, quote, "It doesn't matter where you go. It matters more what you do when you get there. Just go there and work, end quote. So Buddy gets drafted by the Pelicans. Kobe invites him to a one-on-one, two-hour, 6 a.m. workout in Los Angeles. Buddy said his arms were noodles afterwards. Kobe told him, quote, "You know, when I was younger, I'd have come back in the afternoon and done it again," end quote. So Buddy wore number 24 in college. He wore it in New Orleans, and he's been wearing it ever since, arriving in Sactown. The Oklahoma assistant AD tweeted after Sunday's tragic news that he had never met a bigger Kobe fan in his life than Buddy Hield. So last night, Hield and the Sacramento Kings played their first game since Kobe's tragic passing. The game was in Minnesota against the T-Wolves, and it was all T-Wolves for 42 minutes and change. With just under 6 minutes to go in the fourth quarter, the Kings were getting blown out of the building by 22. Then, with a minute and 5 seconds left, they had cut the lead, but it was still 117-105. In other words, T-Wolves, ball game, thanks for coming. And then something wild happened, something crazy, something that we have never seen before in the NBA. The Kings came back, and Buddy Hield scored 9 of their next 12 points in 60 seconds of play before De'Aaron Fox pulled off a miraculous intentional miss off a free throw that he rebounded himself and put back in to tie it up at 119. That sent the game into OT. In just over 1 minute, the Kings finished the fourth quarter on a 14-2 run to force OT. Think about that for a minute. 65 seconds, down 12, and they came back to tie it up somehow, some way. And at that point, there was no way that they were not going to finish it in overtime.
And the Sacramento Kings somehow, some way, win this game. Truly one of the most amazing things I've witnessed in my 32 years of calling Sacramento Kings basketball.
You know that voice, right? You know that voice. 133-129 Kings. The first team in NBA history to overcome a 17-point deficit with 249 or less left on the clock. 8,378 teams have tried that. 8,378 teams had failed until last night. And this is where it gets really strange. As for Buddy Hield, he was playing in Kobe sneakers. He was wearing his idol's number 24. He went for a career-high 42, the reverse number of 24. He did so on 24 shots. He had 5 boards and 3 dimes, which, of course, total up to 8. You can't make this stuff up. Only 2 guys in the past 2 decades have ever scored 20 points on 100% shooting in the fourth quarter to overcome a 25-point deficit. Buddy Hield and Kobe Bryant. Those are the only two. I mean, sports are wild. Here's a kid who grew up in the Bahamas idolizing Kobe. Meets him in college. Works out with him after draft day. Balls out to a career high in a historic win while wearing the number 24. Shortly after his hero tragically passed away. And I mentioned that voice. Longtime fill-in host. Great, great friend of this program. 32-year Sacramento Kings TV broadcaster Grant Napier called that last night the most amazing thing he has ever seen in his post-game interview with Buddy.
Buddy, you had a career-high 42 points during the actual course of the game. How much was Kobe Bryant in your mind? How much were you thinking of him during this game?
I was thinking of him a lot. And even my brother called me, he's like, do it for Kobe. And everybody know how much Kobe meant to me in the Bahamas, all the arguments, all the fight I got in, just showing that he's better than Michael Jordan. You know, I shouldn't say that, but like, that's all I know growing up was Kobe Bryant. Kobe was always that guy for me. And he made me believe, man. And that's why I'm here today, because I wanted to chase what he was chasing. And not saying like all the accolades, but like being in the NBA, because coming from Bahamas is tough, man. And it's a small country with a big heart, and he made me believe. And like I say, in the overtime, I didn't want to score no more because I scored 42 points. I had 5 rebounds, 3 assists. You know, 42, turn that 42 behind, and the round is 24. 5 and 3 assists is 8 points, man. That's all Kobe, man. So I'm blessed.
Buddy, I can't even tell you. I've been doing this 32 years, and I just witnessed the most amazing thing I've ever seen, and you were a big reason for that. Congratulations,
buddy.
It's
all Kobe, man. All for Kobe.
It was all for Kobe. And again, Grant Napier has been a Kings broadcaster for more than three decades and said, I've never had a moment like that. I mean, what a moment. What a comeback. What a game. What a moment. Mamba magic in Minneapolis last night for the Kings. No doubt about that. No doubt about that. Let's go to Los Angeles. Matt in L.A. Hey, Matt, how are you?
Romy, thanks for the vine. It's an honor and a privilege to speak to you as usual, but even more so today in remembrance of L.A. icon, international basketball genius, Kobe Bean Bryant. About a month ago, Pimp, I lost my uncle, Andres. He was really like the first of my family members who was in the NBA with me. And in the 80s, he started off as a Lakers hater. But as Kobe came to his own, you know, he turned, you know, because he loved Kobe's tenacity and just the way he played the game. So his loss combined with the sudden death of the man that I saw restore Laker glory through my 20s and 30s has really made me realize how fragile life is. You know, hug your loved ones, love or reconcile with your family. We're not promised tomorrow. Live your life to the fullest and persevere in everything you do. I also want to, you know, recognize the eight other innocent lives that were also lost on Sunday. God bless those families who lost loved ones. Although it's a tough time, I want to say thank you to number 8/24 for all of the great memories. There will never, ever be another Kobe Bryant. His triumphs, his failures, his redemption, his family, his legacy will all live on. And for the haters who he never shied away from, may Kobe rest in peace. Rest in paradise, because legends live forever. Mamba out.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate that very much. Jason in Atlanta. Jason, good to have you. How are you?
Hey, Jim. I appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts.
It's good to have you. Thanks so much. What's on your mind?
So I grew up in suburban Philly, and so my high school was in the same athletic league as Bowen Marion, Kobe Bryant's high school. And so I'm 8 years older than Kobe, so I was gone by the time he was coming to Media, Pennsylvania to come play against Pencrest High School on our home floor. And I had heard the stories about, you know, people would just talk about how they had never seen the likes of him, you know, prior or since, you know, come through and play again on my high school's home floor. So I always thought that was just crazy. And then I always loved that Kobe still had an affinity for the Philly area. You know, I know that Doug Peterson had him address the Eagles before the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, and then just seeing that video of him reacting the same way I did, the same way me, all my friends did when the Eagles won, you know, Kobe holding his daughter and just running around the room in his house and screaming and jumping up and down. And the last thing is just that I have a daughter who, you know, in 2012, she was a first grader, just like all the kids that died at Sandy Hook. And that same daughter is now 13, same age as Gigi. And so, you know, just like everybody else has mentioned, I just, you know, keep thinking, you know, don't take any relationships in your life for granted because, you know, you just don't know when you may not get to tell them you love them again. That's it.
Thanks, Jason, very much. Texas, Johnny. Hi, Johnny. How are you?
Hey, Jimmy. How are you, buddy?
Good. How about you?
Hey, I'm okay. Listen, I wanted to call in and give my thoughts about Kobe. I think the biggest thing that impacted me when I first heard the news, I saw the TMZ tweet. I thought that there's no way, you know, there's no way that this larger than life figure could be dead. And of course, as the news continued to trickle in, it became apparent that it was true. And to know that he went out with his daughter just absolutely breaks my heart, because I have a girl, and I can't imagine all the times that we've traveled that anything like that could happen to the both of us. But I hope that they were able to, you know, comfort one another when it became apparent that that helicopter was going to go down. So I'm touched by the fact that as a San Antonio Spurs lifelong fan, how amazing the man was and how competitive he was and how he was a stone-cold killer on the court. But the real tragedy in all of this is the people who perished with him and the people that they all left behind. You know, I found myself thinking about, just like what Matt in L.A. just said, I actually made a phone call to a loved one that I had been disenfranchised from for far too long, and I made amends, and we're talking again, and she was glad to accept that call. But life is too short. You know, it may sound cliche to say, you know, reach out to someone and tell them that you love them, but the truth is none of us have mortality, you know, immortality. We're all going to go out at some point, and so it's important to make the best of life. And so I appreciate you providing the focus, the emphasis on your show for Kobe, because the man was obviously very loved, and I've been moved to strong emotion because of this tragedy. So thank you for all you do, Jim. I'm out.
All right, Johnny, thank you very much. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. I mean, nothing is promised, and it's not for any of us to say how or when we go. It's in San Diego, Paul. It's good to have you on, Paul. How are you?
Man, I'm doing great, Romy. How you doing?
Good. Really well.
Man, Romy, listen, man, I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to play, you know, to pay homage to, you know, a legend in Kobe Bryant. And, man, I've been following you for years myself. This is kind of a dream come true, you know, being to be able to hear your voice. I went through a real bad divorce back in 95, and, man, you talked me out of the ledge many times, you know, with your program, your takes, you know, the clones. You know, I remember laughing out loud out there, you know, driving a van, you know, in downtown Los Angeles, man. So thank you for that. My take here, you know, with Kobe, man, you know, listen, I followed this guy, of course, like so many did, for so many years. I'm from Brazil. I played basketball, high school basketball in Brazil, which is predominant soccer, and we all know how you feel about soccer. you know, I was the kind of the odd kid, you know, in there. So when I got here to L.A. in 87, of course, Magic rule at that time. You know, it was all, you know, Showtime Lakers and so on and so forth. And then, of course, we went through a rough patch there when Magic retired, and then came Kobe, you know, and he lift up the city, you know, in a way that it was incredible. You know, of course, the addition of Shaq and then Phil and so forth, and the rest is history. It's unmanageable. I can't imagine, you know, the pain and sorrow that Vanessa is feeling today, and all those involved, you know, all those families involved, you know, that perished on that accident. You know, Sunday morning, you know, my heart goes to them. I have a 13-year-old myself. You know, I got to meet Kobe 5 months ago. My daughter, you know, was invited in as a sub, you know, for a player that was hurt on a team that, you know, the Mamba team, you know, his daughter's team was scrimmage against. And, you know, so my daughter subbed in. And, of course, you know, I was like, yeah, you know, man, I'll call in 2 days off, you know, for this, you know. So we traveled to Orange County in a, you know, private venue. And, man, I've never seen perfection, you know, in kids, you know, like I've seen, you know, Gigi's team, you know. So it was an honor, you know, to see the display, you know, of perfection, you know, that, you know, the hard work that Kobe instilled, you know, in those kids, you know, in a team that he was, you know, coaching. And you know, and my daughter's 14, his daughter's was 13 at that time. And I was like, okay, you know, let's see what this goes. And, man, we got a beat down of 88 points. And it was the most amazing thing, because I never saw so many little Kobes, you know, running around, you know, at one time in synergy, you know. And I saw from everything from fadeaways to triangle to, I mean, it was overwhelming.
I would imagine. Also, Paul, let me jump in. I'm sorry to have to do that to you. I appreciate your thoughts very much. a bunch of little Kobes with fallaways and probably fundamentally sound and playing the game the right way and playing hard for the Kings. No doubt about that. No doubt about that. Let's go to Oakland. Rynell. Good to have you on the show, Rynell. How are you?
I'm good. And yourself, Mr. Rom? How are you doing, man?
Good. Really good. Really good.
Okay. Well, what I would like to say is, you know, we've all seen Kobe and his great basketball accolades. You know, he's done a whole lot for the game. What I will speak as far as the game, we thought there would never be another Jordan. Kobe stepped on the scene. He proved that wrong. The thing I will say about Kobe, he set a precedent. So I think there, in due time, will be another Kobe. He set a work ethic. He set a work ethic. He set a work ethic. Now let's talk post Kobe. With all he had went through in life, you know, whatever God's plan was for him to redeem himself. Four girls. He settled things with his wife. He got back to that. With him growing to be a man, he was able to redeem himself by making his right-hand man was his daughter. When everybody picked up and was, you going to have a boy, you're going to have a boy, he had daughters. He was actually able to make a world for the WNBA. Let's be honest. With the situations he had, he was able to be forgiven from his wife, his family, the media, the world, the people that loved him, that cared about him, you know, and was willing to accept the fact that he's growing into a man. Now, we all are feeling this. We are all feeling this, whether we have sons or daughters. And when I heard about this Sunday morning, my wife told me what was going on. And I don't do social media anymore. I don't mess with TMZ or anything like that. But she looked at the story three times over, and it just sent chills up my spine. It made the hair on my head stand up. And the reason why the world is feeling this, even if they weren't a Kobe fan, if they weren't a Laker fan, is because his last moment was with his daughter. He was with seven other people as well. They had their children there. What hurts us, and I'm sure you have children as well, the last moments, was he able to hold her? Was he able to, you know, honestly tell her that he loved her? Were the other parents able to do the same thing? And it's a hard thing to deal with as a parent, because we all get up, we all do our 9-to-5, we do our 24/7, we do what we do in life. We kiss and hug our children. We kiss and hug our family. And you never know what's coming. And my last words to saying this, because I don't want to ramble on or be cut off, is the fact that we all feel this, man. And my heart goes out to his family. It goes out to his wife. It goes out to the people that knew him, Shaq, Kenny Smith, you, many of the people that know him on a personal level and got to talk to him and deal with him, you know. For us, we were just fans watching TV or going to a game to see him. And my last word is this. Respect and peace, Kobe Bryant. Rest in peace, Gigi Bryant. Rest in peace to the rest of the people that were with him, because with this being talked about, they're going to get lost in the shuffle a little bit here and there.
Appreciate that, Rynell. Thanks so much. We are joined by Javon Kinlaw. Javon, good to have you on. How are you?
I'm pretty good, man. Excited
good.
To be on the show.
It's good to have you on the show. I appreciate you saying that. All right, so you're coming off a week at the Senior Bowl where you absolutely dominated the first couple of practices, and then you shut it down to rest your knee. Scouts, though, were really hyped about what you did in those practices. What was your mindset going into the Senior Bowl practices?
Just got to dominate. That was the only thing really on my mind, just going out there and wanting to just dominate everybody.
Let me ask you this, because one person covering the practices said that you were not blocked at all once you arrived in Mobile. People who know pretty much already knew your game and said that you didn't need to be there. Your draft stock was already really high. So why did you want to go?
Just wanted to get in front of the coaches and show them what I could really do, you know what I'm saying, in a one-on-one type of environment, you know, and just get a chance to let everybody really know and understand where I'm coming from and some of the things that I faced to even get to the Senior Bowl. So I was grateful for the opportunity.
Javon Kinlaw, right? Javon Kinlaw joining us. You know, you mentioned some of the things that you had to go through to get there, which I want to get to. But the thing is, showing up on the big stage is it's nothing new for you. You did that against Alabama. You did that against Georgia. You did that against Florida, Missouri, Texas A&M. Like, you've got this rare ability to dominate a game without racking up huge stats. How much of your game then is about strength and flexibility, and how much of it is just about the mental side of the game?
All of it is really mental, honestly. But I mean, you know, strength and flexibility and things like that play into it. But if your mindset not right going into it, you know, you really could have a tough day out there. Versus if you got the right mindset, go out there, you focus, you locked in, you know your assignments and things like that. So you're gonna really excel. So that's really the difference, you know.
Javon Kinlaw joining us. Now, you could have entered the draft last year, and in fact, you received a first-round grade, but you said that you went back to school because you felt like you didn't accomplish anything. That was the actual quote. Why was that? And do you feel like coming back for another season, were you able to accomplish what you were looking to, or maybe is there still unfinished business? Where are you at now?
Well, last year I played with a torn hip labrum, so I felt like I had so much more to show. So I just decided to come back. I really never thought about leaving, honestly. And then once I came back, you know, I set the bar so high. I wanted like 15 sacks. I didn't get close, so I felt like for myself, I didn't really accomplish anything that I wanted to accomplish.
Thing is, you know, we talked about the mental aspect or the mental approach. Those who watch you rave about your mental toughness and the fact that you had to overcome so much to even get where you are right now. When you were growing up in Northeast Washington, D.C., with your mother and your brothers, it was not easy, right? Life was not always easy. What was that time like for you?
For sure. Just to set the record straight, I was born in North Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. But I spent a little bit of most of my childhood in Washington, D.C.
And okay.
Just growing up in D.C., you had to grow up faster than, you know, the kids that was around your age, especially going through things like what I was going through, you know, battling, trying to find somewhere to live, and you seeing stuff like that and you understanding it at a young age, you know, it just kind of sticks with you throughout your whole life. You never kind of forget about it. That's kind of always what drives me. I just don't want to ever put my kids in that situation. Not that it was my mom's fault, you know. She was a hardworking person, you know. But we just got the short end of the stick most of the times in life. And that's just how it was, you know. Like I said, we never really complained or anything like that. But just now, it definitely drives me to just be the best I can be at all times.
Javon Kinlaw joining us. And what makes that special, what you're saying is, another part of this story is, your daughter is turning 2 this spring. So what, especially given what you went through, what does she mean to you, and what's it like to be a father?
She's going to be 1 year old in March. But just seeing her grow up, just seeing the way she's growing up, and really me knowing that she never going to have to go through some of the things that I went through, you know, pretty much all of them, you know, she's going to always be taken care of, you know, that's my main goal. So in order to get that done, you know, I'm going to go out and I'm going to attack it every day, you know what I'm saying? Just try to give her the childhood that I always wished of and things like that. So she always going to be a driving force in my life, no matter if it's the first snap of my career or it's the last. I'm always going to be thinking about her, always wanting to set the example.
Hey, Javon, you said something interesting that above and beyond this, where obviously you want to do what you can always do to help your family, but you were looking at something even beyond that. You said, quote, "I just want to show people that it's okay to be a good father. These young fathers, I want to show them it's okay. You don't need to be scared. You just got to do what you got to do. People are going to respect that at the end of the day," end of quote. So why is it important to you not only to be a good father to your daughter, but also to be a role model for other fathers as well?
I feel like fathers sometimes might not get enough respect, you know, especially when you're a good one, when you're doing everything that you're supposed to be doing, you're taking care of yours. You should really, that should really be, you know, a big thing in America nowadays, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, it's not enough fathers stepping up, doing their job, doing what they're supposed to do, you know? And I really take pride in that, you know what I'm saying? I take a whole lot of pride in that, you know, me just always being there. I miss her all the time when I'm not there. I just always want to be there, be around her to let her know that, you know, that her father is always going to be there for her, you know?
It's great. Javon Kinlan, my guest. So because of all that hard work, you are now in a position where you're going to be paid to play football, and you're going to be able to take care of the people that you love. How much are you looking forward to that, and what does that mean to you?
It means a whole lot to me, honestly, because I really wasn't supposed to be in this position to be able to take care of everybody like I want to. Not everybody, but just all the ones that was really down and out with me in a lot of situations, you know. But that means a lot to me. Like I said, I don't think nobody really expected me to take this far, you know, but it's gonna go a lot further for me because I know what I'm capable of and what I'm capable of accomplishing and things like that. And I just wanna learn and become a better football player at all times. So I think that's gonna just drive me to become the ultimate football player.
All right, so finally, if nobody expected this, and here you are, have you allowed yourself to think about what it's going to feel like when you hear your name called on draft night?
It's going to be a good day, you know. It's probably not going to be very emotional for me because I'm the one that put in the work, you know. I've seen every day. I've seen the progression. I'm the one that really worked towards getting better. A lot of people helped me on this journey, but at the end of the day, I was the one to put the work in. So it's not really going to be very emotional for me because I already knew, you know, what was going to come out of this. Because I really bought in, and I just never settled. So I knew what time it was going to be already.
So what would you do on days? Would you ever get up in the morning and think to yourself, man, I'm just not feeling it. I've been hitting this thing so hard. I think I'm going to take today off. Or has your approach been no days off? No days off.
Man, I'm sure everybody go through those days where they have those tough moments. They laying in the bed. They want to lay in the bed. But something always made me just get up, you know. Just something in my head, a certain voice in my head always just told me, you can't lay there. You got to go. You got to make it happen. So that's what that's the difference between me and just everybody else, I think. It was definitely a voice in my head. But there's plenty of days I could have just chose to, you know, just sit back and let things come to me instead of attacking it like which I did, so, for sure.
Good night now!